This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In December 2000, as the nation held its breath over the supercharged Bush-Gore Florida recount, Bill Clinton, Jeb Bush, and more gathered at the White House to sign off on the largest environmental restoration project in the history of the planet, an $8 billion rescue of the incomparable but deeply damaged Florida Everglades. Ponce de Leon was mortally wounded there. Alligators, egrets, and ghost orchids lived. U.S. soldiers died fighting Seminoles. American dreams of life in sunshine paradise nearly killed the place. Now the Katrina-battered Gulf Coast is watching, and its fate is still unclear. Up next on Point, we're going deep in the Everglades, the swamp, and the politics of paradise. And later in this hour, we'll take a trip to China to hear about the Three Gorges Dam and changes on the Yangtze River. But first, the Everglades. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Michael Grunwald, prize-winning national reporter for The Washington Post. His new book is The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. Mike Grunwald, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
There is so much we want to talk about here. Lessons maybe for the Gulf Coast before and certainly after Katrina. Issues here for ecosystem reconstruction, restoration, rescue worldwide. American politics, sugar money, boomers and retirees of all stripes headed down to Florida. But I wish you'd do us a favor first and just give us a kind of a satellite eye view, if you'd be good enough, Mike, of the Everglades as they were and the Everglades as they are. If you were looking down from that Martian view or from the satellite, how did they look? How do they look now?
Sure. Well, in their natural state, the Everglades themselves really began where Lake Okeechobee spilled over its lower lip into a vast sawgrass marsh. And it really was a river of grass, but the broadest, slowest moving river in the world. And it really kind of trickled all the way down to Florida Bay and the 10,000 Islands. It was essentially it looked like the world's largest meadow, but just really wet, or an incredibly large cornfield, but really wild.
And in its pristine state from that enormous Lake Okeechobee, if you looked south, the maps I'm looking at in your book here, it's almost the entire enormous southern tip of Florida that's covered by combination of the Everglades and Big Cypress Swamp.
Well, in its natural state, pretty much all of southern Florida was wet. People forget it today when there are 7 million people there and 40 million annual tourists, and it seems like 100 million golf courses and strip malls and T-shirt shops. But the early mapmakers, they weren't sure whether they should draw it as land or water.
What's it been chopped down to? Take the same satellite eye view today, looking down on Florida. How do the Everglades look? What's grown up around them?
Well, it's been pretty much chopped in half. The northern Everglades is now the Everglades Agricultural Area. There are 450,000 acres of sugar fields up there.
This is just south of Lake Okeechobee.
Yes, exactly.
It used to run over the lip. That was dammed, the Hoover Dike there, and vast sugar fields there.
Exactly. It's now completely cut off from Lake Okeechobee. That was the wellspring of the Everglades. People used to call it the heart and lungs of the Everglades. Mm-hmm. Now it's essentially a reservoir. And the central Everglades, which are now called water conservation areas, but that's a nice word for also pretty much used as a reservoir and a sewer in times of flood. The eastern Everglades and the coastal ridge has now been developed. It's, as anyone who's been down there knows, it's kind of a suburban megalopolis
this
now.
This is right up against, you name it, from Miami North, Fort Lauderdale.
West Palm Beach. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even now heading up into Jupiter and Stewart and heading west all the way to the Everglades Perimeter Levee.
How many miles is that from the coast? How many miles inland has the suburban development eaten now?
It depends on the area, but some areas 25 miles.
Okay.
Some areas not quite that much. But, there are a lot of people living where the alligators used to live. They get upset when they find the alligators in their backyard.
So cane fields in the north. On the east, you've got, the sort of Boynton Beach sprawl headed deep into the Everglades. What about the southern tip, the west?
Well, on the southwest tip, you've got Everglades National Park, which was the first national park that was set up for really its biology rather than its scenery. And it's still in its natural condition, but, you know, you can't develop there. But what we've learned
in recent
years is that—
Natural, except the waters are not flowing through it from Lake Okeechobee.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You can't just build a fence around a national park that's essentially a water park like mm-hmm. the Everglades mm-hmm. is. And so right now it's an ecological mess. It's sometimes it's too dry, sometimes it's too wet, it's always too polluted, and it's certainly too convoluted. You know, the water is dammed and diked and by levees and highways and canals, and it just doesn't flow the way it used to.
Then what about on the western side, the Gulf of Mexico, Naples, and all that? What's the eat away there?
Well, it's coming late to the game. It stayed relatively pristine for a lot longer, but that's where the boom is now, and there's no levee on that side. So we're about to spend $8 billion, and in fact, now the latest estimate is $10.8 billion to try to fix some of the mistakes that were made on the southeast coast. But some of those same mistakes are being made on the southwest coast. It's heading east fast.
You call it the swamp. But, you know, anywhere you look, they say it's a subtropical marshland. Why do you call it a swamp, Mike Unwell?
Well, for one thing, the sawgrass Everglades is a marsh because it's kind of a technical term because its main vegetation is grassy and not mm-hmm. woody. Mm-hmm. But the Everglades ecosystem, which really covered all of South Florida, was much more than marshes. It was certainly more than sawgrass marshes. It was muligrass marshes. It was cypress swamps. It was pine flatwoods. It was bays. It was ponds. It was all kinds of different habitats that were all connected by water. But I'd be lying if I didn't say there was a bit of a double entendre to the swamp.
Because it's become the reservoir, the sewer, as you put it, cut off from the flow of water.
And there's also a bit of a political implication mm-hmm. I'm trying to get in there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of nasty politics surrounding the Everglades for the last 150 years.
We're going to look at those. Take us into flora and fauna at its height, that it's in its pristine state, and today.
Well, the Everglades is a remarkable place. It's not the Grand Canyon. It's not Yellowstone National Park. The guidebooks, even today, they'll say that, you know, it takes some getting used to. It guards its secrets jealously, that kind of thing.
You have grown men weeping in the Everglades. They just find it so foreign and fearsome.
Well, it's a tough slog, you know. It feels like bathing in broken glass when you walk through that place. And it's muddy and it's mushy and it's hot. And there are mosquitoes, and there are snakes, and there are weird lizards.
Alligators and crocodiles, you note.
Exactly. The only place on Earth where they're side by side.
But what's still there? Are the great flocks of birds there, the ibis and the egret and the stork, or is it something else now?
Well, they're flocks. It's a question of how great they are now. People say that more than 90% of the wading birds that were there in the 20s and 30s have gone elsewhere. The Florida panther, there are about 80 left. Some of them were being born without testicles because they were so inbred. You really see nature out of whack in South Florida. You see Melaleuca trees that were planted to drain the swamp way back when have now proliferated, and they've covered 1 million acres of the Everglades. You've got, you know, weird lizards that don't belong there. You've got the evil weevil is spreading through. You've just got a whole bunch of things that are not the way it was.
Mike, what does it matter if the Everglades survive? I mean, you've got so many retirees and others down there now, and now a gazillion boomers looking toward the sun like retirees often have. I mean, I know the $10 billion is supposed to push the other way. You say maybe it won't. What if the Everglades went away? What's the cost?
Well, that's a terrific question, and there are two real answers. One is, no, there are no other Everglades. There's no other place like it on Earth. And, there are 69 endangered species right now, and if you lose the Everglades, you're probably going to lose those 69. You can say, you know, maybe those roseate spoonbills will one day be found to cure cancer. Maybe they're part of, you know, the food web that something we need, we'll rely on. But really, I mean, here's a place that's really different. It's singular, and we've got it. It's in the care custody of the United States of America. And it would be a kind of sad thing for the millions of people who visit every year if it was gone. But there also is a human element, too. The aquifers that sit under the Everglades really depend on the health of the ecosystem, and that's where South Florida gets most of its drinking water. And I think that one thing that we've found in recent years is that as man has sprawled into the Everglades, it hasn't necessarily helped his quality of life. You know, now he's sitting in traffic. His schools are so overcrowded that in Broward County, the kids start lining up for lunch at 9:50 in the morning. Mm. They're running out of water, and you can't visit this beautiful place the way you could in the past. People who like to go fishing are finding that Lake Okeechobee is the color of espresso right now. And the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee estuaries, I mean, they're really going to hell. I mean, you've got manatees and dolphins that are going belly up in front of people's eyes. You've got red tide so bad that you can't go to the beach. So there's a real, you know, people are beginning to feel it too.
So you could lose it, and for what? While, as you have it, Tommy Lee Jones and Bruce Springsteen and Michael Bloomberg, New York mayor, build their mega houses in the cane fields. Michael Grunewald, we want to look at what's going on with this restoration program, but a little historical context is probably good here. I mean, you had U.S. soldiers chasing Seminole all over the place. They held out a long time. War is always hell, but Florida seemed worse. One of the soldiers wrote, we've all heard about Broward County from Florida politics. You quote the Florida governor of years back, Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, saying, yes, the Everglades is a swamp, but so was Chicago 60 years ago. For a long time, conservation and land use was focused not on restoring or even maintaining, but really on destroying the Everglades intentionally, wasn't it?
Well, Broward was a great conservationist. The conservationists of that day thought that the Everglades
was a wasteland.
That
day being when, Mike?
Broward was at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. And here was this vast wasteland full of mosquitoes and alligators and other useless creatures. And, you know, the ultimate conservation, reclamation, improvement project would be to make these Everglades do some work for people. That's what God told man to do, to subdue the earth and take dominion over it. And the idea that this could create an empire of the Everglades is what Broward called it, that it could be a great agricultural and commercial success. That was seen as the essence of conservation, the greatest conservation project in the country.
For a long time, people's dreams, stoked by all kinds of marketing out of Florida, sank into those swamps. I mean, it didn't work. It wasn't easy to reclaim the Everglades.
Yeah, I've bought land by the acre, but I've never bought land by the gallon. It's the famous quote down there. The place really became a real estate punchline. Everybody was always promising that just around the corner, the Everglades was going to be drained because it seemed so easy. Water runs downhill. But there isn't a lot of downhill in the Everglades. And it took a long time, and people started moving in long before the Everglades was really ready for it. You started to have, you know, these canals would carry off water in the dry season that was desperately needed, and you'd start to see fires and saltwater intrusion and soil subsidence. And then in the wet season, these canals weren't big enough to stop the flooding. And most famously, in 1928, a hurricane came up and it blew Lake Okeechobee right through a flimsy muck dike, killed 2,500 people in the Everglades.
Okeechobee essentially just emptied back into its traditional path.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's sort of Mother Nature taking back her own. And, most of the people who happened to be in the way were blacks, poor field hands who didn't really have any way out. And, so there's some modern echoes there.
But finally, the dredging machines had their way. The dike along Okeechobee, the southern tip got bigger. Right under that, the big cane fields came in. Sugar became a political and economic power for a while. And, of course, the chomping away from the east. And then, and we'll come to this, 2000, a great big decision. But the outcome of it, we don't know yet. Let's hear from Florida. We've got Reese calling from Miami. Hi, Reese, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I visited Everglades, the first time was 1977, and I really fall in love with this big swamp. I see it from the air almost every day, 2,000 to 5,000 feet. We fly into Miami Airport. we fly over the glades. It's the most beautiful swamp I ever known. I have visited many times. I drove through it to the parks, and I hate to see it. It's dying right now.
Why is it dying, and do you trust it's going to be turned around, Reese?
I have seen Everglades from the air, and there's a huge sugarcane farm just south of Lake Okeechobee, just north of the swamp.
Yep.
And I believe the most of the toxic and a poison comes from that plant and sugarcane farms into the water of the Everglades.
But now we're talking about billions to restore the Everglades. Do you believe it will happen?
I think it's going to come back. I think it's going to turn around. I hope they spend money on it. I hate to see it die. It's the most beautiful system in Florida or anywhere else on the planet of Earth.
That's a great report from the pilot who flies over it all the time, Reese. We appreciate your firsthand account. Let's keep on the firsthand account line here. Joining us from Everglades National Park is Alan Scott. He's a park ranger at the national park there. Mr. Scott, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mike.
We're looking for you to sort of take us up close here with the Everglades as they are today, the beauty, but also the evidence you can see firsthand of what's being lost there, Alan Scott.
First of all, if you visited today, I mean today in the month of March, and you went to a certain number of locations like the Anhinga Trail at Royal Palm or Shark Valley, you would see fantastic wildlife. Because right now we are in the middle of the dry season, and the wildlife is concentrated wherever there's water left.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see and be very impressed by the wildlife of the Everglades. But what you don't understand when you see that is what it could be like. In the last 100 years or so, the wildlife has changed dramatically. Everglades National Park is just a part of the Everglades ecosystem, the tail end of it, the downstream end of it that's protected. And there are natural systems taking place in Everglades National Park. But it used to be a huge system, covering all of South Florida, all the way between the Florida Keys up to Orlando. And most of that area outside the park has now been changed. Areas where fish used to breed and where birds used to feed, they're not there anymore. Shorelines where fresh water flowed into salt water, making estuaries, those are developed. They're no longer estuaries, or there's fewer fish.
Alan Scott, it was about, I'm not sure, 10, 15 years ago when alligator hunting was reopened in the in Florida. I was sent down as a reporter to cover that and spent a quite amazing night in the Everglades with a bunch of happy but quite drunken Floridians with shotguns and hooks and you name it, hunting alligators. Is that still going on?
The state does permit alligator hunting. It does it on a controlled basis. That does not occur in Everglades National Park, however. The alligator population has recovered dramatically, and that's kind of an example of what I think could happen to the whole Everglades if given the chance. It could recover like the alligator population has.
We're going to get to politics in just a minute, but what's your confidence, Ranger Scott, that the big multi-billion-dollar restoration project is going to work?
Well, most of what, you probably have already talked about this, but most of what is in the comprehensive Everglades restoration plan is water supply and flood protection for people who live in this part of the world with benefits and to the whole Everglades ecosystem. Hopefully what it will do is save some of the water that's being dumped to tide currently so it can flow through the wetlands longer and give a place for the plants and the animals to live. I think this is our best chance at this time. I mean, the state government and the federal government have agreed to do this. If it doesn't happen, I don't know what's going to happen next for the Everglades. I think there are controls on development outside the park, but there could be development right up to the park boundary. The system has changed dramatically. We need to do something now in order to protect the wetlands that are left outside of Everglades National Park, other wetlands in parts of the Everglades ecosystem, because now is the chance to do that.
Ranger Alan Scott at the Everglades National Park in Florida, thanks so much for being with us.
You're You're very welcome.
All right, Michael Grunewald, you've got to take us straight to us. What was going on in that White House meeting in the year 2000? $7.8 billion at that time. Now you say it's nearly $10 billion. Does that mean we can sit back and say, we've done it. We've saved the Everglades?
Well, Alan spoke beautifully about the ecosystem, but he was also being a little bit diplomatic. The scientists at Everglades National Park have been extremely critical of this Everglades restoration plan. In fact, in one kind of famous stink bomb they put out at the end of 1998, they said, it's not restoration at all. And there are very deep concerns that there are swift and sure economic benefits for sugar farmers and people living in the cities and suburbs and for rock miners. But the benefits for the Everglades itself are extremely uncertain and certainly delayed for decades.
Well, so what's going on? Explain it to us. Have they pulled the trigger on spending this $10 billion? What's happening? What's supposed to happen?
Well, right now it's mostly planning. The best way to think about Everglades restoration is to think of it as a big water storage project. This is water that used to be stored by the wetlands of the Everglades and then seeped naturally down the south of the peninsula. Instead, it's been kind of shot out to tide. You know, the history of Florida has been trying to get rid of its water. In one of the plans, they actually called it, we need to get rid of the evil being the water.
So if you save the water, do you save the Everglades, or do you just build a big reservoir that, I don't know, drowns them? Just, is it really for more suburbs, or is it for the Everglades?
Well, the key is to get the water right. You want to get it in the right places at the right time with the right quality and the right amounts. And that's not going to be easy. There's a lot of dispute about how to do it. The scientists tend to err on the side of, well, it used to start at the top and flow down through the middle and then come out at the bottom. So let's try to recreate that flow. Unfortunately, there are a lot of levees and highways in the way. The scientists tend to focus on, well, why don't we get rid of the levees and try to raise the highways? But that creates a lot of other problems for flood control, for people who live along the levees, for water usage for the sugar farmers, and for just water usage for the entire region.
Let me just ask you, what about that huge cork of sugar farming right at the southern base of Lake Okeechobee? Is that ever going away, or is it presumed that flow will never come again? That's in history.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I know your caller had suggested that that big sugar was kind of the root of the problem. And don't get me wrong, big sugar is a problem, and a lot of the things that people say about their political clout is true. It is true that, Alfonso Fanjul got the president on the phone while he was breaking up with his girlfriend for 22 minutes. These are powerful guys, and they do cause problems in the Everglades. For one thing, they're obviously in the way. They're in the former Everglades. The water doesn't flow through them the way it used to. Mm. They also do pollute, though not nearly as much as they used to, thanks to an Everglades cleanup project that's been going on for 12 years now.
And it's not a profitable industry. I mean, this is a subsidized business in America these days.
That is absolutely right. There is a sugar program. They don't like to call them subsidies. But essentially, yes, we pay more for sugar than we need to, and it's because of the government program to protect the sugar industry.
So are they the bad guys?
All those things are true. Well, they're in business, and they're in business to make money. And one of the fears is, sugar is certainly not as benign for the Everglades as, say, Everglades, or certainly as a reservoir even. But it's a lot better than vegetable farms, and it's way better than condos. And what the sugar guys like to say is, hey, if you don't let us grow sugar, it's our land. We'll grow condos.
And they're doing that already, not just condos. You write about Tommy Lee Jones playing polo down there and Bruce Springsteen and Michael Bloomberg with their big houses. It's happening.
There are people who would love to start moving into the Everglades agricultural area with some really serious development plans, and that could be the next Broward County. And if that happens, it's really hard to see how the Everglades survives. I mean, people have to, people love to complain about big sugar, but if you really look at historically what the biggest problem in the Everglades has been, it's big people.
And people want to live there, and a whole lot more may be coming with the boomers. Let's take a call from Grinnell, Iowa. Chase is calling. Hi, Chase. You're on the air.
Hi. My grandfather was actually a land developer in Florida in the 50s, and he founded a town in the Jupiter area called Sequesta. And I feel like because of all the development that's already happened in Florida, it's almost a lost cause. It's really sad, but the way I've observed Florida politics, I grew up there,
it
seems like Floridians either don't understand the value of the Everglades or just aren't willing to change the way they live every day to accommodate the Everglades. And I was wondering for the guest whether he thinks that it's possible for the Everglades to sustain itself with the money from the government and the cleanup projects if Floridians just continue to live their suburban lives and continue to, you know, use as many natural resources as they like. It's my impression that no matter how much money the government tries to throw at, you know, cleanup projects for the small amount of the Everglades that remain, we're in trouble because Floridians are going to keep wasting natural resources where they live, and they live so close to the Everglades already.
We've got it, Chase. Thank you for that. Mike Grunwald, there's the grandson of one of the many developers saying, well, what's your answer? Is it going to work?
You know, I hear that question a lot, and I actually have a very strong response to it. I've really come to believe that the Everglades is not doomed. It can be saved. There are a lot of people in Florida, and I don't deny, you know, it was a lot of fun writing about the political shenanigans that have been going on there for so long. But you also have to remember, there are millions of acres that are now in public control. You know, you've got the canvas. Unfortunately, the canvas is shrinking every day, but it's still possible to paint a masterpiece on it. There's good science. There are people who know what they're doing. There are people who want to do the right thing. I think a lot of people kind of throw their arms up in the air because things are always so, you know, there's been such a history in Florida with the schemers and dreamers. And they say, you know, what could we possibly do? And I'm not saying it's going to be easy. It's going to be hard, and it's going to take political mobilization. But I think some enviros are too quick to say either, you know, this is hopeless, I'm just going to throw bricks from outside the system, or they say, you know what, this is hopeless, I'm just going to take the first deal that's offered.
Let's get a call. Gray is calling from Potomac. Gray, you're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom. I used to be a teacher at the University of Florida, and I taught groundwater modeling, and I had dealings with various of the water management districts, and finally I basically threw up my hands.
Because?
I'd like to ask Michael a question about aquifer storage and recovery programs that were underway some years ago, if they're still absorbing huge amounts of money. Basically, the program was designed to capture the high flows in the springtime by pumping the water into the ground so that it would hopefully be there later in the year so that it could be pumped out when the water wasn't as plentiful.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the people who planned it, in my estimation, didn't understand the geology and the hydrogeology of Florida, because that works where you have a sand pile where the water flows uniformly through the sand at a particular slow rate. But if you have a pipe through in underground and the water flows through the pipe, it leaves the area long before it can be recovered.
And so that's not quite working. Gray, let us put it to Mike Grunwald. Mike, what is working and what's not in this big restoration program?
Well, I can answer your question about ASR. The bad news is that Everglades restoration was heavily dependent on ASR. They were it was going to be $2 billion the cost to build more underground wells than have ever been built. The good news, I suppose, is that the guys who are running Everglades restoration seem to have decided that it ain't going to work, and they're already scrambling to try to find new solutions.
But big picture, Mike, in very simple terms, what's working and what's not in this restoration?
Well, there's been I will say that this is where it's gotta happen. You know, people say the Everglades is a test. You know, if we pass, we may get to keep the planet. And I think that's right. This is the test of kind of whether we can live sustainably, whether we can live in harmony with nature.
But on the ground, what's going on? What's working? What's not?
Well, what you start to see is that people are getting tired. There's sort of too much water, or there's not enough water, and the bill is coming due. Right now, you see Lake Okeechobee, which is too high from too much rain, but they can't send it down into the Everglades the way they usually can, or they historically would have. So they're pumping it out into the estuaries, and the estuaries are dying. And you've got people noticing, and you've got people revolting. So that's sort of, I would say that the kind of political mobilization is just starting to happen. You see on the East Coast, Governor Bush, Governor Jeb Bush, who's not known as necessarily the environmental community's best friend, just stepped in to block some westward sprawl to try to hold the line of the urban development boundary. So I'd say that's one positive sign. Some of the pollution stuff is getting better too. The stuff off the sugar fields, it's not as dirty as it was. The big problems are still just the development continues to expand. It's hard to tell somebody not to develop in a place, and it's very hard to tell somebody who already has a place you're in the way.
In the way of nature.
Well, exactly, or even in the way of where we're going to put nature through our great new restoration project. I mean, I think what they have not figured out yet is sort of how they're going to get the water right. And until they can do that, you're going to kind of have the proverbial 10 pounds of you-know-what in the 5-pound bag.
Mike, stand by. I want to just get a perspective quickly here from the Gulf Coast, which has had its own marsh erosion loss problems for a long time, aggravated by Hurricane Katrina. We're joined from New Orleans by Shea Penlin. He's director of the Pontchartrain Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of New Orleans. Mr. Penlin, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What are you learning from the huge Everglades restoration plan that might be applicable in your neck of the woods?
Well, as you know, we've proposed a $14 billion program of wetland restoration in South Louisiana, and we looked to Florida because that's considered the largest ecological restoration project in the United States. And it's a challenge, as your other guest is saying, is I think there's too many people involved. There aren't enough big projects to take some first big steps. And that's, I think, and we've looked at the Everglades to tell us, what have you learned there? And I think that what we need to learn from the Everglades is that we need leadership at the state level. We need large-scale fiscal commitment to a few big projects. We, since 1990, we've built over 100 $10 million, $20 million restoration projects, and we've pretty well, I think, know what works and what doesn't work. And now, right before Katrina, we were getting ready to move forward with what was considered LCA, the Louisiana Coastal Area Study, that was going to put $1.9 billion on the table and do five big projects. And that first big step was because we learned that a bunch of small steps really won't get a sustainable ecosystem that we need in South Louisiana. I think it's the same challenge in Florida. They're seeing the same thing.
So you're saying technically you think you know how to do it. It's political will to get it done and the money behind that will?
I think technically, yes, we know what needs to be done to get things going. We need to put a couple $100 million, $200 million of projects onto the ground now and at the same time have ongoing work that will identify the second big step. I mean, we know, maybe it's not the perfect project, but we've been waiting for 20 years to figure out what the perfect project was, and we've reinvented the wheel now probably three times. The concept of a great idea has been re-engineered three times. We end up with the same one or two big projects, and we just need to get going with those projects, doing large-scale barrier island restoration, large-scale wetland restoration. Just do it. Learn from it instead of always being apprehensive about doing these big projects. We need to do them now.
Just do it, says Shea Penlin at the University of New Orleans on the Gulf Coast. Mr. Penlin, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mike Grunwald, we've just got a minute here. What's going to really pop this open? Most of this money hasn't even been touched. It hasn't been spent. It's not happening. What's it going to take?
I think, it's going to have to take pressure. Everybody's watching the Everglades, the Chesapeake Bay, the Great Lakes, Garden of Eden marshes in Iraq. Everybody's looking to see what happens in the Everglades to see if, the 21st century can be a time of ecosystem restoration, to see if, we can maybe prevent some of the water wars that people are talking about dominating geopolitics in the next century. It's going to take a lot of money, it's going to take a lot of science, and it's going to take a lot of political will. And sometimes it's going to take saying to well-connected political interests. No, you can't have that.
You've
and
got
so
a
far,
clock
I
ticking.
Really seen that.
You've got boomers looking south and a clock ticking. How long does the Everglades have? How big is the window to realize restoration or something like it, anything like it?
Well, it's hard to know. You know, in 1947, when Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wrote River of Grass, she said her last chapter was called The 11th Hour. You know, the Everglades is dying, she said. And you know, we had barely just started to screw them up. So, nature is very resilient.
Michael Gunwald, author of the new book, The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. Wonderful talking with you, Michael. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
In a moment, a journey into another changing waterway, China's Yangtze River. This is On Point. Where there's water, there are people. And where there are people, there's change. Perhaps no place on the planet is changing faster today than China's Yangtze River Valley. The 4,000-mile-long river holds what many say is the key to China's economic future, energy and electricity. In 1994, the Chinese government began construction of the massive Three Gorges Dam. This year, the project moves into the final phases, with a finish date set for 2009. At a cost of $25 billion, the Three Gorges Dam is one of the world's largest and most controversial public works projects, and it is changing the Yangtze River Valley, the environment, and people in profound ways. On Point producer Meghna Chakrabarty was recently in central China. She took a trip up the Yangtze and through the Three Gorges, sending back this report.
We board the creaking old river cruiser here, in Hubei province, at the port city of Yichang. It's a bustling, go-go kind of place. The Yangtze River matches that energy, pulsing against the docks with water that's thick, gritty, and brown as chocolate milk. Locals like to call Yichang China's most powerful city. The reason why is 25 miles upstream and exactly where we're headed. The Three Gorges Dam is the biggest, most controversial hydroelectric project in the world. It's so massive that we have to climb up a mountain to the visitor center to see the entire structure. It's 600 feet high, 1.3 miles long. Imagine a gigantic wall of concrete, like five Hoover dams, side by side. And it's powerful, designed to generate 18.2 gigawatts of electricity, enough to satisfy the average annual power demand of a city seven times the size of Los Angeles. Edward is our guide from Yichang. He points down to the river.
This is the upstream of the Yangtze, and the water level at another side of the dam, it is 135 meters. So now the drop is 70 meters, over 200 feet.
The dam is critical for China, he says. The nation's economy is hungry for more power, and right now, China's per capita power consumption is barely 10% of the United States. The dam, he adds, will also provide essential irrigation and flood control. But the cost to rein in the Yangtze's wild waters is also high. Behind the dam rises the Three Gorges Reservoir, a 375-mile-long stretch of the river that, when finished in 2009, will have flooded almost 2 million people out of their homes. These relocatees, as Edward calls them, are mostly farmers. They're being moved by the government to new factory cities or to higher ground, farming terraces where the soil isn't as fertile. They have no choice. The destiny of the nation depends on the dam, or so I hear from an audio recording playing everywhere at the visitor center, the voice of a pleasant young woman speaking only in English, never in Chinese.
Make contributions to the present age, but also benefit the nation and people for centuries.
Day two. We enter the locks. Like everything here, they're huge. Getting through them takes time. Three hours later, the last doors open. For the next 350 miles, the Yangtze unfurls westward before us, snaking through the Three Gorges, between mountains that rise from the water like jagged, majestic hunks of jade. It's on the other side of the gorges that you begin to see just how radically the Yangtze is being transformed. Countless ships, from big coal freighters to tiny sampans, jostle each other along the busy waterway. Construction is everywhere. Hundreds of villages and cities are being built at breathtaking pace on higher ground. And every half mile or so, marking that higher ground, there are what look like giant black and white tape measures laid out vertically on the hillsides. They mark 577 feet, the ultimate height of the reservoir, and they're placed right next to homes and shrines so that people can watch and know as the water rises inch by inch. Day 3. We drift by Fengji, a city that just a few years ago was rebuilt directly above the bleached bones of its former self. Right under the waterline, there's a startling sight, the submerged rooftops and terraces of old Fengji. How do the citizens of Fengji feel, I wonder, living with the drowned relics of their old city? It's strange, a little otherworldly, as if China is moving so fast, the past has not been given time to fade away before the future takes its place. But the past remains ever-present in China, and I encounter it on day 4, at a place called the Dragon's Gate. He is Chen Xiaowu, a 55-year-old farmer raised on the Madu River. Chen Xiaowu once grew corn and sweet potatoes on the far side of one of the local mountains. Now he works for the tour company. He speaks a dialect that's disappearing from this part of China. So when Chen Xiaowu offers to sing us a song, the guide just shrugs. He can't make out what it means, except that there's something in it about love. Day 5. We cruise the last 100 miles to the megacity of Chongqing. We float by the ancient tombs, the fishing grounds, and the darting sampans. These artifacts of old China are here for now. But in 3 years, the dam will be done, and the reservoir will swell to its full height. Then, the mountains might seem a little smaller. The riverbanks might feel a little crowded with the ghosts of a submerged world. But the country will have its power, and the Yangtze River will still flow, inexorably, toward whatever future China chooses to make for itself.
Meghna Chakrabarty is a producer for On Point. You can find more information on the Three Gorges Dam and a photo gallery of Yangtze River images at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.